right. Well, good morning. It's good to be with you all here on this rather kind of cold Mother's Day, actually. But as they say, we warm in our hearts, and maybe especially today, given the subject matter, we'll be able to kindle a little fire here to just keep ourselves warm. I'm actually here on Mother's Day, and the mother of my children is not here because she is at home with our two little girls, and they have pink eye. Actually, all three of them do right now. So a little bit difficult, but that is why we appreciate you mothers. We thank you for all the runny noses. We thank you for all the meals, all the late nights and early mornings. And we do appreciate the moms in our lives. We love you, and you guys deserve a special day. So it's actually funny. I kind of opened with that, and I couldn't resist. Just kind of came to me as I was getting ready to come up here, a little opening joke. And we were on the phone yesterday with my brother-in-law, and he asked, because he found out I was going to be speaking today, so he asked, do you ever start with a joke? And Amber said, always. And I thought, oh, that's not good. Not, you know, always. It's just too predictable, you know? So I thought, okay, that's no jokes for tomorrow. No jokes. But I guess I already failed on that one. But I guess you maybe next time we'll get that taken care of. And another, you know, it's interesting as well. I've actually been reading this book recently on preaching, and it's a very good book. It's very practical. It gives some nice little insights. And another thing they talk about is how you don't want to avoid repetition, doing the same thing over and over again. And I noticed that one of the things that I kind of have a tendency towards is alliteration, right? Starting all the same points with the same letter, you know, four A's or four B's, whatever. And he said, you know, don't do that all the time. And I was like, I'm not going to do that this time. But I was at work thinking about my message, and all of a sudden it just kind of hit me that Daniel chapter 3 was all about fame, fire, and faithfulness. So it just kind of... You know, it just kind of struck me, and I wasn't even trying, and so I just kind of thought, you know, it must be the leading of the Lord. But in all seriousness, I'm going to try not to to stick on each point or belabor them too much. I like to let this flow a little more freely and be a little more organic. So I'm going to attempt that. But Daniel chapter 3, we all know the story well. At least we think we do. And, of course, you have King Nebuchadnezzar, who built an idol. He built this image that he commanded every person that was there to worship. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or if you're familiar with VeggieTales, Rakshak and Beni, refused to bow down to the idol, and they were thrown into the furnace. And, of course, as we know, God rescued them from the furnace. If I spoiled that ending for you, I am very sorry. I'm sure that everybody here is well-versed in this story. But there's actually so many things to take out of this story, and so I'm excited to share it with you, because I think as we look at it, we'll see how much there really is to glean from this chapter that we know so well, a Sunday school story that we often think we have a handle on, but there's so much here. So let's just jump right in at verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits, and its width 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So Daniel chapter 3 starts with the words Nebuchadnezzar, the king. And it's interesting to me that I've noticed when I was kind of scanning over Daniel just a little bit to get some parameters here, the first four chapters of Daniel start with King Nebuchadnezzar. In the first verse, or in the opening segment of each chapter, King Nebuchadnezzar. He's far from a background character in all of this story of Daniel and the history of what's going on here. In fact, he's a very prominent person in the book of Daniel and also in world history. King Nebuchadnezzar, he was the greatest king of Babylon, the greatest king of probably the greatest empire. In fact, as we have studied, when King Nebuchadnezzar had the dream of the image, Babylon was the head of gold on that image. They would be the most glorious kingdom of the four major world powers that would rule this earth, going all the way down to the Roman Empire. they have actually excavated the city of Babylon quite extensively, and they found many, many amazing things about Babylon. They have found massive statues and religious items that are made out of pure gold. Unbelievable, the wealth that was there in Babylon. It was a city of gold. The walls of Babylon were 15 miles long on each side. And though at times the ancient historians were often considered to be a little bit exaggerated in their claims, modern archaeology has actually proven for the most part that their claims to be accurate and true. Walls 300 feet high and 80 feet thick. Unbelievable, the massive structures that they had built. Bronze gates and drawbridges that were taken in at night all around the city, 25 of them. A moat that surrounded the entire city to protect. It just went on and on, I could read on about many of the different things. The hanging gardens that King Nebuchadnezzar built for his wife to remind her of her homeland, as the story goes, were one of the seven wonders of the world. So Babylon was an amazing place, and King Nebuchadnezzar had the glory of that kingdom. In fact, we even have words of Nebuchadnezzar recorded. Upon those walls that surrounded the exterior were glazed bricks. And on those glazed bricks, there's reliefs of lions. And on those lions and underneath those lions, it says, "I am Nebuchadnezzar." And you can see that around. And there's public works that he did. But in his inaugural address, you can see where his heart lay in all of this and all the things that he had done. He prayed to his gods. He prayed that his name and his throne would endure, that he would have many offspring, and that all the kings of the earth would bring him glory, would bring him tribute. And he was concerned about his legacy. And so this is the man that built this image. He was a prosperous man in one of the most prosperous times in a very prominent city. And his desire and his goal was that his name would be remembered. So we can see very clearly at the right at the very beginning of this passage, this is no coincidence that he built this image. He made an image of gold. He made an image completely of gold. Now, it may have been wood overlaid with gold, some people theorize, but the object of it was that he was referring to the dream, or going back to the dream that had been shown to him before. And in that dream, he had the head of gold, and then the other kingdoms followed. But in his image, it was gold from head to toe. This image that King Nebuchadnezzar built was in direct contradiction to the prophecy and to the dream that God had revealed to him. He was standing in opposition to God. The word image there, it actually means an idolatrous image. So it was made with the express intent that it was to be worshipped. That was the point of it. According to the Septuagint, this episode took place about 18 years after the dream was revealed. So we don't have that written in the Bible, but that's what tradition states. And it got me thinking that if that's the case, that in those 18 years, perhaps Nebuchadnezzar had become so secure in his kingdom, his enemies defeated, that he felt that perhaps he could create a new legacy. Perhaps he could overthrow the will of sovereign God, or this God of the Jews that he had heard about, and create a legacy that would endure and that would last. This image was 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. So in our day and age, that would be 90, you know, it's times and a half. So it's 90 feet high, 9 feet wide. Seems kind of like a little bit of a messed up, disproportionate being if it was to be a human. They say that perhaps there was a pedestal there, that was there, and then the image was on top of that pedestal. And as a matter of fact, that was one of the things that they've also excavated from the ruins in Babylon, is a giant pedestal. They think that it could have held a colossal statue of that size. But I thought that it was kind of, telling that 60 cubits high, 6 cubits wide. And if you're into numerology at all, you might think about that as being the number of man, as we hear about, right? So man's attempt at creating this this worship and this religion. So Nebuchadnezzar set this all up. And he set it up in a location where it could be viewed plainly in the plain of Dura. And that could potentially be in a number of different locations outside the city of Babylon or perhaps even in the city of Babylon. But the main point of it is that it would be in a spot where it would not be competing with other objects around it. And so people would be able to walk up to it and behold the impressiveness of this statue and its dimensions and the gold and just be in awe of it. That was the goal of it. So he sent word in verse chapter 2. The king sent word to assemble, and you can read through the list. Basically, he's assembling all the higher-ups in the kingdom, the brass, the top brass, those who had positions of authority. And they came to the dedication, or you can read there, the consecration of this image, and they stood before it. So they were all gathered in to stand before this image. They were summoned, and this was not just a request, you know, a social gathering or event. This was a mandatory meeting, mandatory staff meeting, if you will, of all the higher-ups. They were all to come and stand before this image, and so here they were. And no doubt, as they stood there, they probably beheld this image, and they would have been impressed by it. You think about what it's like if we go and we take the elevator up the Space Needle, or if any of you have ever gone to see the Statue of Liberty, I never have, but if you have gone, to kind of marvel at something that man has made. And certainly something made out of gold like that and that high and that wide would have caught your attention out on an open plain like that. They stood before it, and maybe they're wondering, what are we doing here? And as they stood there, there was a dedication to this image or a consecration. So there was probably some type of religious ceremony that was being unfolded before them there as it was consecrated. It was going to be consecrated as Nebuchadnezzar was going to usher in this new form of worship. And people have also, you know, postulated about what it could have been. It might have been an image of his father or of his God or maybe even of himself. And that wouldn't have been the first time in all of history, and it certainly won't be the last time that somebody will actually set themselves up in the place of God. It's kind of unbelievable sometimes, maybe to us, to think that somebody would take that position. I don't know if it was himself, but it was this image that he made. You know, King Nebuchadnezzar, he was focused on fame. He was focused on renown. He wanted his name to be carried on through all generations. And it has been carried on through all generations. But isn't that in the heart of man? Isn't that the nature of people today still? Is that people want to be famous? They want to be known? That should not be the goal of us as Christians. Our goal in life should not to be the most renowned or the most well-known. And I think that it's a good word of warning because it is so prevalent in the world today that is something to attain to. You know, my wife and I were kind of getting a kick out of We were watching, it was called The Millennial Proposal. And it was like this little YouTube video. And so this couple, he was proposing, and then she stopped. No, you don't have that quite right. You need to do it from this angle. And, you know, she had to have her hair a certain way. And as it continued to go on, finally they got everything right. And it was like slow motion, and her hair just kind of like, you know, goes flying back. And he drops on a knee, and it was perfect. And at the very end, you see her, and she's like looking. You think she's looking at her ring, but she's actually looking at her phone. She's like, it's beautiful. Look at all these likes I have, you know. And she's scrolling up through all of her likes. That is perhaps very, maybe an indictment, I don't know, but like that seems to be the culture we're living in today. Everybody wants to be famous. Everybody wants their 15 minutes of fame. But that's not the goal for us as Christians. It's not to be famous. It's to be faithful. Is to be faithful to what God has called us to do. And I will grant you that there are people that God has called, and they do stand out from the crowd. They are elevated to a stature, and people do recognize their names, but that shouldn't be what we strive after. If God puts that in your path, then that's in your path. But it shouldn't be something that we work towards or that is our goal in life. So he had his first priority was his fame. But he also instituted this false religion, and it was already illustrated as in that opening segment there that Dave read about false gods and false idols who have no lips to speak, have no eyes to see. In the book of Isaiah, you can read about how idols are formed. And you can read about how foolish it is that mankind can build these idols with their hands. They actually have to transport them by beasts of burden. And then they have to set them up and they have to nail them down so they don't fall over. And after all this work that people do to set up their idols, they bow down and they say, "You are God. We worship you." And it seems so ridiculous to us. And yet, life today in this world we live in is exactly the same way. The gods have not changed. Their forms have changed, but the gods have not changed. People still worship the idol of gold. They still worship all sorts of things that men have created. They worship people. We have hero worship. We worship sin. People worship sin in their lives, immorality and drunkenness and all sorts of things that they strive after. And you can just see it everywhere around us. These are the things that the world worships. And it started at the top. He was very intentional in what he was doing. He brought in all these people and he made sure that it was the people who were the heads of their departments all throughout his kingdom. And his goal was to indoctrinate them into this form of worship, and then he was going to pass it on down. It's like that today in our culture. Think about the people who wield the most influence. It's the movie stars, the rock stars. It's the politicians. It's the people who are well known by everyone. And when they begin a trend, when they begin a movement, people follow along. Most people are going to follow that. It was also something that was forced. It was a forced following. Look at verse 4. So everyone was gathered here, and then there was a herald, this man who loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language." He loudly proclaimed it. And that word there, it means with force, like an army. So this wasn't just some voluntary act of submission. This was a pronouncement. And you notice that it was accompanied by music, beautiful music. They've talked about the music over and over again in this passage. They talk about all the different kinds of instruments there were. Now, I don't know about any of you out there. Maybe, is there any zither players out there? Or maybe psaltery? I know Uncle Arnett plays the bagpipes, but I don't know if anybody else does. But there were a lot of different kinds of music, and you have to imagine that it was probably very beautiful music. Music is a wonderful thing. Music is a way to bring honor and glory to God and worship. But music can have a very coercive effect on people. It can wear down our senses. Our body and our minds and our hearts become involved when we listen to music. Music invigorates us with feelings, with emotions, and they're very powerful. And music can be used to wonderful effect, or it can be used to devastating effect, depending on the bent of it. And I'd actually just like to take that opportunity to just put out a little word of warning, especially to you young people, about the kind of music you choose to listen to. Because in this passage, this entire scene was carefully orchestrated. And they recognized, those that organized it, the power that music would have on these people, combined with the forcefulness of the words. And when I look back to when I was younger, I must admit that a lot of the music I listened to was not honoring to God. I didn't even really think about it. It was just what was out there. And it was considered to be cool, and it was considered to be fun, and it had an exciting sound to it. But when I look back now and I think about what some of those songs are portraying, it just saddens me to think that I did that just unheedingly and unthinkingly. So we need to be careful about that. There's I pulled this quote out of commentary from Matthew Henry. It speaks to the attitudes of the world. It speaks to what happens to people in general when a new form of worship, or when something is brought to them, placed before them. "There is nothing so bad which the careless world will not be drawn to by a concert of music, or driven to by a fiery furnace." So people are very susceptible, and they're followers. People will follow just about anything. So therefore, at that time, it says, the herald said, whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And of course, we always ask, what's the therefore, therefore? Well, now we know what it's there for. Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound, and men of every language, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. So they didn't want to die. That's why they bowed down. That's what brought them to their knees. This blazing fire. Now, I suppose there could have been some different reactions amidst the crowd. There probably were some different categories of people that you could have seen there. Some people would have been like, yes, this is awesome. I love it. Golden image, worshiping the king. I'm all for this. This is awesome. I love Babylon. I love gold. I love Nebuchadnezzar. Sign me up. And there are people like that today. Just the world is enough. Everything that's out there. But I think there might have been another contingent of people. I think there could have been people who just went along to get along. You know, it's kind of like, I don't want to make waves. This is kind of what's accepted in my culture. And I'm okay with this. I'm not 100% behind it, but it's what I've become accustomed to. It's what I've grown up with. This is what we're doing, so I'm going to do it too. I'm not going to be the one to stand up and say anything. And I think there may have even been some people there who thought to themselves, I don't really agree with this, but there's this fiery furnace over there, and if I refuse, I'm going to die. And I don't want to die. And so they bowed down too. So everybody there. You know, the term turn or burn has often been equated to Christianity. But in reality, if you think about it, turn or burn is a method. It's a mindset of the world. I heard recently that over the last 100 years, over 100 million people have died because of isms. Isms. Nazism, Stalinism, Fascism, communism, all these different isms, 100 million people. And world religion is really no different. If you look through the ages, you can see the effect and what mankind is willing to do to gather everybody under his goal, under their plan. You may even see here an example of what's going to be unraveled in the future as the Antichrist comes to the throne. It uses the same language, talking about the Antichrist, that men of every language, nation, tongue, and tribe, he will be given authority. And if anybody does not worship the image, then they will be put to death. So it's nothing new, and it's nothing that is done with yet. So everybody bowed down. Everybody. Except for three people, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In verse number 8, you'll see these men called the Chaldeans, they came forward. And the Chaldeans were a class of magicians and astrologers. They were priests, they were advisors to the king. I guess I can see some of the Coolidge guys back there nodding their heads because they know, because they're history buffs. And if you want any more information on Babylon or these men, you can talk to them. I'm sure they will enlighten you even further. They were a class of people. They were also a people group from the southern part of Babylon that the king was probably related to in some way. And so they came before the king with this charge. These three men, O king, have not bowed. Now, as you read through this passage, it appears to me, my best guess is that these men probably had ulterior motives in their approach to the king. You see, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had been promoted in the kingdom of Babylon, as we know from chapter 1 and 2. when at Daniel's request. They had prayed with Daniel, and it was actually the prayers and it was actually the faithfulness of these men that saved the Chaldeans' lives so that they were not killed. And this was the reward that they got. This was the payback they got. That's the way it is in life. I hope that all of us recognize that as we walk through life and as we live, that there are going to be some people whose loyalty in life is only to themselves, whose bottom line in life will be political gain or personal gain for themselves. And that if you and I stand in the way because of our convictions or because of a stand we take, they will absolutely be willing to bulldoze us, trample us underfoot, take us down. It happens. So just as we walk through life, just be aware of that. And don't take it personally. Just expect it and accept it. Let God allows these things to happen. And it's not always our fault. God allows people to test us. God allows people to be against us and against his people. But notice their reproach here in verse 9. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, "O king, live forever." You know, they were very... You read these three verses here, and you can see, or these four, 9, 10, 11, and 12. You can just kind of see how well prepared and well versed they were as they came to the king. They had this little speech kind of planned out. And the first thing that they started off with was a little bit of flattery. "O king, live forever." They knew that his goal and his desire would that his name would endure. It would carry on. And so they utilized that. They approached him from that basis. "King, we love you. You're awesome. We just want you to reign forever. You look so good today. You know, is that a new robe? That really just brings out your eyes. I don't remember you wearing that crown before. Did you just get that gold pounded out the other day? Because it is so bright, so clean. You just look amazing." Just a little bit of flattery. You know, God hates lips that are lying, and he hates tongues that are flattering. It is something that is not acceptable. As Christians, that should never define us. That should never be something that comes out of our mouths. When we speak to people, our talk should be clear. And it's okay to be complimentary to people, but that compliment should be genuine. It should come from your heart. When we speak to people, and in our hearts we have a motive of getting something back, that's an abomination to God. To God, he looks at that and he's very sad and disappointed, and he hates that. So let it be a warning to us, and let it also be a warning to us to not accept flattery from other people. And again, when somebody says something to you, we use the word flattering, I suppose, often, but when it's something that somebody says that's nice, and it is well-intentioned and it's meant, most of the time we're able to understand that it's coming from a good place. And sometimes we notice that somebody is actually trying to flatter us with their words. And you got to be very, very careful. Because usually when somebody's trying to flatter you with their words, they want something from you. And if you are like King Nebuchadnezzar, then you're just being ripened for a fall. They were buttering him up, and he was susceptible to it because of his pride. They were very persuasive in their speech. They appealed to his pride as well. They said, "O king, you've made this command. And if everybody who hears the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, this beautiful music that we've been hearing, is to fall down and worship the golden image, but whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. King, don't forget about your command here. Remember, you're the one who set this command into motion, and now these three men have disobeyed your command, so what are you going to do? You wouldn't want to go back on your word. I mean, you know, other people might start doing the same thing. You don't want that." They appealed to his pride. "Remember the command that you made." I think that King Nebuchadnezzar probably, at least for the most part, it was probably a bluff. He probably did not expect that people were going to rebel against his authority. This was just kind of a contingency plan. You know, "Hey, everybody, have a good time. Enjoy the music. just bow down and worship. And we've got this beautiful image here. There's probably some, you know, wonderful food and all sorts of things. And, oh, but just, you know, by the way, you know, if, you know, you're having second thoughts, just remember, right over here, burning furnace, death, you know, marshmallow burning, maybe barbecue afterwards or whatever, you know, just, it was, I think it was kind of more of a contingency plan. And yet, there's these three men who refuse to bow. And now the king is placed in this position. And he becomes angry. That is his response. These men, you know, they had political motives in this. I think they wanted the position of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They had been promoted above them, this group of Chaldeans who had failed the king before. They had seen others, foreigners, overtake their place, and now they wanted those positions, and this was a golden opportunity for them to take them over. They resorted to personal attacks. These men do not regard you. They disregard you. They don't worship your image. They don't serve your gods. They knew that these men had been faithful to King Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar knew these men had been faithful to him in all matters pertaining to the kingdom, but in this one thing, they would not bow down. But these people used this as leverage against them. They used it to instigate the king against these men. They used it as an opportunity to tear them down. And again, that is how it works in the world. Maybe you've experienced that. I always go back in my mind whenever things like this come up. I remember an instance at work a number of years ago. There was this lady I worked with. And man, I tell you, she was out to get me. She just completely stabbed me in the back every time she had a chance. She was always talking me down to other people. And, you know, the funny thing is that, and it was really affecting my work environment, and I was getting heat from my boss, all sorts of stuff. The funny thing is that she eventually transferred to a different school. And the next year after she transferred, smooth sailing, no problems. You know, my reviews were all good. I was just more comfortable at work. People noticed the work that I did or whatever. And it was because somebody had went out of their way to be subversive, went out of their way to throw personal attacks at me. And maybe that's happened with you too. But just be reminded that God will stand with you. God knows your service. God knows your work ethic. And he's on your side. And no matter what people do to you or try to take you down with, God will be faithful to you if you are faithful to him in your work environment. So I hope that you take some encouragement from that. Because as we will see here, God does vindicate these men. So let's keep moving on here. In verse chapter 13, in verse 13 in this chapter, Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king. So they were brought to give an account for what they had done. And King Nebuchadnezzar was extremely angry with them. You know, I personally hate confrontation. And it doesn't matter to me whether I'm in the right or whether I'm in the wrong. I hate having those face-to-face confrontations. And I hate making other people feel bad, to be honest. Sometimes it's almost like I know that what they did perhaps was wrong, but I hate making them feel bad, you know? And so here comes Nebuchadnezzar to these men, and he gives them another chance. He gives them another chance to change their minds. And I think, again, I don't think that he initially expected that these men would actually disobey his command, that they would defy the order of the king. He said, now, okay, I'm mad here, but if you guys are ready now, okay, start the lovely music again, everybody. Okay, places, everyone, places, and then if you're ready now, then all is well. It's fine, very well, if you can bow down. But if not, and at this time he was instigated to complete anger and rage, and he was ready to throw them into the furnace. If not, there's the furnace. And their answer to him was so clear. It was still respectful, but it was clear. They said, King, we don't need to give an answer to you for our actions here. If it be so, and you're going to throw us in the furnace, our God is able to deliver us. But if not, let it be known to you that we will not bow down to your idol or worship your image. And I think that the response there is so, it's just so uniform. There was a unity there. They were all together in this. And when I think about that, I think about the power of friendship. I think about our relationships as Christians. They stood firm together. Another quote from Matthew Henry: "Fear of man and love of the world, especially want of faith, make men yield to temptation, while a firm persuasion of the truth will deliver them from denying Christ or being ashamed of him. We are to be meek in our replies, but we must be decided that we will obey God rather than man." You could think of, you know, some examples of that throughout the Bible, of people that decided to obey God rather than man. Unfortunately, when I look back again in my life as a younger person, and again, I would just like to appeal to younger people. I remember when I was younger, so many times, unfortunately, very unfortunately, I feel as though my convictions were not set in stone until I had been faced with a situation, a temptation, whatever it might have been, that I was not prepared to deal with. I had not made up my mind ahead of time that I wasn't going to bow down or that I wasn't going to accept this thing. And that's not always the case. There were times where I did do that, where I did stand up. But I wish I had been more prepared. I wish that I would have had better friends around me sometimes too. Amber and I were reading this thing recently, talked about you are the average of your five closest friends. You are the average of your five closest friends. Sometimes we try to seek to bring people up. Our hearts kind of reach out to those who are maybe in a worse spot than we are, who are having a difficult time, and we want to raise them up. And that's a wonderful thing, but we have to be very careful about the people we surround ourselves with. Because more often than not, if you were down there and I was up here and I tried to lift you up and you tried to pull me down, who's going to win that battle? You're going to pull me down. You have all the leverage. You have gravity on your side. And it's so much easier to just fall backwards and pull down than it is to lift someone up like that. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they stood together. It started with the king's wine and the king's meat that they refused to eat. And now it's progressed to this stage. If you're weak in the small things, if you have no conviction in the small things, you're not going to have conviction in the big things. You've got to get your mindset right now. You got to get it right while you're young, as you're stepping out into life, as you're stepping out into this world. You know, as I look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and this may seem kind of strange, but I think that their lives are actually closer to the day-to-day lives that we live than we realize. We think of them as living in an ancient world so long ago, nothing like our own. No, they lived in a world and in a culture very much like our own. They lived in the most prominent culture on earth. They lived in the most wealthy place on earth, just like we do here in the United States and in this region. We have so much. And they lived around all the idolatry. They lived around all the excess and all the things that these people around them were living out. But they remained set apart in their lives. They were different. And it should be the same way with us as we walk in our lives day to day. Sure, we go to the same restaurants. We dress maybe the same. We go to the same parks. We drive the same roads. We go to the same places of employment. But our lives should be set apart. They should be distinct. They should be different than the lives of those around us. They trusted in God. And it didn't matter to them if they were going to live or if they were going to die. They were going to hold fast. You know, it says in the New Testament, it says, you have not resisted yet to the point of blood. And that was something that was spoken to the New Testament churches. That's something that we can apply to our lives today too. We've not resisted in our lives to the point of blood. At least I don't think anybody here has when it comes to our faith. They were willing to give all for their faith. And so many times in our culture today, in our lives today, we are afraid. We're soft. We're used to stepping back. Why? Because that's what the higher-ups, that's what the people in places of authority have told us that we need to do. Don't say anything. You guys, you need to be respectful of all people. We need to be a culture of inclusiveness. It's okay to be respectful of other people. But I will tell you, the times that I have spoken up boldly and spoken against the gods of this age and the idols that people worship today, or the things that have been passed on that are accepted in our culture, have been few and far between. And we oftentimes are just so used to just wanting to get along with everybody. But we should be willing to stand out. What's your trial that you're going through today? These three men faced an incredible trial. They were faced with a furnace of blazing fire, and yet they stood strong. And it didn't matter that the king heated this furnace seven times over. He became so angry. In verse 19, he answered by giving orders to heat the furnace seven times more than it was usually heated. He commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. Then these men were tied up in their trousers and their coats, their caps, their other clothes, and were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. For this command, because the king's command was urgent, and the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. So what's your trial today? Are you going through a difficult time in your family life? Are you going through a difficult time in your profession, your work? Personally, are you going through a lot of stress? Are you going through attacks from the enemy? Each one of us will face so many different trials that we will go through in life. And just like the furnace that was kindled seven times hotter, sometimes the temperature just keeps going up and up and up in our lives. Does your faith have a melting point? Will you crack under pressure? Or will you stand firm? Will you stand out? Will you be willing to say, no, I'm not going to bow down. I'm not going to cave in to those things I'm susceptible to. I'm going to hold fast to God. That's what they did. And they were thrown into the fire. But there's something more than just suffering for Christ. It's not just us remaining faithful and then having to deal with the fire that is placed upon us or that we were thrown into. There's a result to our faithfulness. There's a result in the world around us. And for these men here, as they remained faithful, they were thrown in. And Nebuchadnezzar stood outside that furnace and he watched. He resumed his place perhaps on his throne or wherever he was sitting as he watched, and he thought that he had dealt with his enemies. Suddenly he was astonished, it says, and he jumped up and he looked into that furnace and he began to do some quick math. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. And he turned to his attendants, and I don't know if they were watching too, or if they, maybe he thought, did we throw somebody else in there? Was there another guy that was hiding in the corner that was had tried to get away? He was part of this group and we threw him in too? Is that why there's four? Didn't we just throw three men in there? Yes, O king, we threw three men in there. I see four men in there. I see four, and they're walking around and they're loosed from their bonds. And the fourth man, he looks like a son of the gods. What in the world is going on? How are they not burning up? Why have they not been extinguished? I don't understand. And so he approached the furnace and he called out to them. It says he came to the door of the furnace and he called out, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out. You servants of the living God, and come out here. You servants of the Most High God. Servants of the Most High God. And as I read that, and as I've been looking over these passages over and over again, I got to thinking, who told Nebuchadnezzar that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God was the Most High God? Who told him that he was the Most High God? Well, it could have been Daniel, I suppose. He had a relationship with Daniel. Daniel had come there many times, but we don't read that. Daniel referred to God, but he didn't refer to him as the Most High God in the chapters we have here. But Nebuchadnezzar had set up this false image to his gods or to himself. He thought that he could usurp the will of God in building this image. He thought that he could come up with his own religious system, his own religion, that he could pass on through all generations, that he would be able to outwit and outmaneuver God, that he would be able to define his own legacy for all of time. And the men who had stood up to him, the men who had defied him, he had cast them into the blazing fiery furnace, fully expecting that there was no God who could save them from his wrath. And yet there they were walking out. And they came out before him. They came out standing before all these men who had come to bow down to the idolatrous image. All these governors and all these rulers, they came out and stood before them. And they all stood there in awe as they looked and beheld that not a hair of their heads had been singed. Nothing on them had been burnt. The only thing that had been broken was the ropes that had tied them were the only things that were gone. The testimony of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And there are examples that we can look at throughout the Bible, throughout all of history, and even in our day and age. And we often, you know, one story we often go back to, Jim Elliot, Pete Fleming, Nate Saint, these guys, these men who went down there to Ecuador, and they died at the hands of the Indians down there. Amazing story. What did Jim Elliot say? He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. All of us have one life that we can give. And whether our God saves us from the burning fire or whether he lets us pass through it, he'll be with us. He will make sure that our lives are a testimony to those around us. We have it so easy here in the United States. There are people across the world who literally are dying for their faith today. They're giving up everything because they will not forsake the name of Christ. And you and I today have the opportunity to not forsake the name of Christ as we walk through this world. Let us walk carefully. Let us be like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Even though we live in a culture that's saturated with evil, even though we may dress like the people around us, go to the same places to socialize and to gather, work in the same businesses, let us make sure that our lives are set apart, that we refuse to bow. We have to get over this idea of being politically correct somehow. Because God has called us to testify to his name. The Lord Jesus told his disciples, "Bear witness of me in all nations." Bringing people to Christ. Talking about who Jesus is. We have to find a way. And I'm not here to tell you how to do it. I know that I myself need to work on it in my own heart. Because I work in an environment where we need to be careful. We need to make sure not to offend anybody. But we need to find a way to tell people about Christ. So here we have at the end, coming full circle, and I hope that this has been beneficial to you. King Nebuchadnezzar, he calls him out of the furnace, and now he makes a new decree that no one is to speak any evil against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Because if they do, then they will be torn limb from limb, and their houses will be turned into a pile of rubble. I don't know. He still had an anger problem. God was working. I don't know where his mother was, you know. But God was still working on the heart of Nebuchadnezzar. But little by little, you can see, as we read through the book of Daniel, you'll see little by little, this man who was the most prominent man, the king of this pagan nation, that little by little, God was working on his heart. And I believe as we look on, and I don't want to steal somebody else's thunder going into the next chapters, but if you read the language of the next chapters, I believe that it speaks to a personal relationship. I think that Nebuchadnezzar became acquainted with the God of Israel. I think that there was a real change that took place in his heart as he would say, "I praise and extol the name of the Most High God." Something personal there. Perhaps not. Perhaps you disagree with me. That's okay. But I think that I see something there. But, you know, it took years and years of faithful service for men like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel, witnessing to him, being faithful. He said, there is no other God who's able to deliver like this God. He recognized that. And in verse 28 here, his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any God except their own God. They gained his respect. Even though they disobeyed him, they gained his respect. And eventually they gained a new person, a convert. So I hope that we can take something away from that today as we seek to stand apart from the crowd, be set apart in our lives, and do that to God's glory. Let's just quickly pray. Lord, we thank you that these men were an example that we can look to, who stood apart for you, unwilling to bow to the idol of their day, no matter the commandment of the king, no matter that all people around them were following suit and going along with this form of worship that had been set up. And we too, in our day, Lord, we need to be very careful that every decision that we make and every step that we take in this life is a step that is being walked in obedience to you. You do desire us to honor those who are in command of our nations, those who have authority over us, and yet we know that it is we are required to obey God rather than man, and that you have given us a command to speak to all men, to tell them about who Jesus Christ is, to be a witness and a testimony. And these three men, Father, are a shining example. We don't read much more about what they had to say. We know that it couldn't have been comfortable for them to stand there. Certainly, the moment of confrontation when they stood before this king could not have been an enjoyable thing. Being wrapped up and thrown into a fire could not have been an easy moment. And yet, they were willing to sacrifice everything. Help us just to take a page from this book, Lord. Help us to apply these lessons to our lives. And help us to walk away from here invigorated, Father, and seeking just with all of our heart's desire to honor you in every aspect of our lives and remain faithful to you until the very end. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.